So when I told Matt what the title of my talk was going to be, he asked me, do you mean hyperbolicity and numerical relativity or in numerical relativity? And I foolishly said at the time in, and that's the printed title, but now I've gone back to and. So now Neil is once again permitted to leave the room if he wishes due to false advertising. Yeah. So this is not going to be a kind of systematic exposition of some subject. It's just going to be a collection of different things that I've thought about at various times, in particular also during the past couple of weeks, which have to do with this theme, the significance or otherwise of the notion of hyperbolicity for numerical relativity. So here I've just listed the five different topics that I'm going to mention, which are kind of loosely related with each other. First is the 3 plus 1 decomposition of the vacuum Einstein equation. Secondly, I want to just say something about what hyperbolicity really means. It's a slightly delicate concept in a way, which is why it's easy for a lot of misunderstandings and so on to arise. Then I'm going to describe an interesting example due to Courant and Lax, which illustrates some points. That has nothing to do with Los Angeles International Airport. Then I'm going to talk a bit about how it is possible to identify that the system you're given is well posed. And finally, I wanted to say something about the Bono-Maso system. So I'll start with something which is very well known and what we've seen many times in past weeks already. So I look at a 3 plus 1 decomposition of the vacuum Einstein equations, vacuum for simplicity. And once more for simplicity, I just take Gauss coordinates. So Laplace function is equal to 1, shift is equal to 0. Now, one thing when you do the 3 plus 1 decomposition of the Einstein equations, what the constraint equations are, that's clear, there's no ambiguity. But what the evolution equations are is ambiguous, as I guess all of us know, because the evolution equations are really just a complement in the space of all equations to the constraints, and you can take different complements. So to be clear what system I'm talking about here, I here specify that what I'm calling the evolution equations are those which you get by setting the space-space components of the four-dimensional Ricci to zero. And then this is the form of the evolution equations where the curvature term on the right-hand side is just Ricci and there's no admixture of the scalar curvature. So that's just one particular form. And now if we start from, of course, there's no reason why this particular form is preferred, or at least not obviously. There are many forms you could take. For instance, you could take here the Einstein tensor rather than Ricci. But so connected with that is the freedom to add a multiple of the Hamiltonian constraint to this evolution equation. Of course, in principle, you could also add multiples of the momentum constraint, but it seems to me that somehow that there's no way which is so natural to add multiples of the momentum constraint without introducing some background quantities. In the case of the Hamiltonian constraint, if you just take that, which is a scalar quantity times the metric, then that's a natural thing that you can add, multiplied by some constant. So that would also be possible in principle. What is there any? Do you have a particular reason for saying that it's very unpleasant?
Yeah.
Well, in any case, I never tried doing that, and I'm just here. I'm just talking about this simple postulate. That's true, yeah. My question in the at the moment is not to try and figure out what is the most general thing I could add. What I want to do is to just take one particularly simple and natural case and see what happens in certain respects. Let's see. One other potential ambiguity here is that when I say I use this for evolution, this is under the understanding that I'm using k. If I was using pi, then the statement I take, the four-dimensional Ricci, would be a different statement. But you can translate, of course, any assumption you make writing the equations in terms of k to a similar assumption for the ADM pi variable. Okay, so I now just simply substitute in this this change into the equations, and these are then, or these at least include the curvature terms, and then you can ask, and many people have asked, is this system hyperbolic as it stands? Is it well posed? What we know is that if we take this equation together with the constraints, then we can sort of indirectly show that everything's well posed. But here I'm not doing this, and of course, as we've heard many times, if you're thinking about numerics, you can't do this because you never know that the constraint is exactly satisfied. So you somehow have to take seriously the equation you have for possibly constraint violating initial data. So the question is this well posed? And the answer at the moment is, unfortunately, nobody knows. What do we know? Well, the one thing is, in the case A equals zero, Helmut Friedrich calculated the characteristics of this equation and found that the characteristics are all real. And that's, at any rate, a necessary condition for hyperbolicity, but it's not a sufficient condition. So here, at certain points on my transparencies, I have some questions with red stars, which I think would be interesting questions to be answered. And one of them is, what happens for A not equal to zero? That's, in principle, a straightforward calculation to do, but as far as I know, nobody's actually checked whether the characteristics of this equation for A not equal to zero are real. Just to see, for a start, at least if that necessary condition for hyperbolicity is satisfied. There are maybe reasons to suspect, and I'll say more about this later, that if A is very far from zero in one particular direction, in particular if A is very negative, then this might no longer be the case. But I haven't tried the calculation. Now, another point is when I talk about well posed, then I'm generally thinking about something being well posed in C infinity, in infinitely differentiable functions, or possibly some finite differentiability like Sobolev spaces. That's not the distinction that I'm interested in here. I just wanted to mention that equations which are not well posed in the C infinity sense may be well posed in other spaces, like so-called Gevre spaces. There is this theory of Lorée and Euler, which allows you to handle a more general class of equations. However, my suspicion is that this is probably not, I mean, even if this system, well, firstly I have the question, is this equation one well posed in Gevre spaces? And Yvonne Choquet-Bouloir has examined related questions, but this particular question here is still open. But actually, it seems to me, but this is just a kind of first impression, that even if we knew that this system were well posed in Jevry spaces, then that wouldn't be a statement which would be so relevant for numerics. The reason is that these, so what does it mean to say it's well posed in Jevry spaces? It means that in these particular spaces, you have stability. So if you control this Jevry norm of the initial data, then you control the solution. However, this norm involves infinitely many derivatives. So it's hard to see how, in the context of a numerical calculation, where sort of by definition you've only got a finite amount of information, you could ever control that kind of norm. I also asked Kreis about this, and that was also his opinion, that probably this wouldn't be so useful, but I don't have really a deep analysis of this question to offer. Okay, so I So I remember you making a comment on that before, and I need to hear more about this, but somehow it seems to me strange in the sense that it's known that there are initial data for the Laplace equation for which there is no solution. So I don't quite know how you get around that, but we should discuss this sometime later. Yeah. Yeah, well, yeah, well, I guess I need to learn about that. Vince? Well, that's also conceivable. However, I mean, in many cases, when you lose derivatives, it's a sign of some more serious thing that's wrong with the equation, which you won't be able to cure by going to C and N. It's not ruled out, but yeah. So my suspicion is it doesn't mean anything. My suspicion is that if there is a code that works and which is not just computing something completely different, I mean, which is really solving the equation it's supposed to solve, then the equations should be well posed in solvable space or in C infinity. Yes. So this is the reason for, I mean, analytically now, for finding a statement about solving the Cauchy problem in Jevry spaces better than just for analytic functions with Cauchy-Kovalevska, because, as Yvonne says, for these spaces you have the ordinary kind of domain of dependence for hyperbolic equations that you can. On the initial data, you can change initial data over here without changing the solution everywhere. So you have a domain of dependence still, which you wouldn't have in the analytic case, where if you change something somewhere, it causes a change everywhere. Okay. So what I want to do now is, since I don't have more to say about directly about the well-posedness of the system 1, the original 3 plus 1 decomposition, I want to say something about the question of propagation of the constraints. Now, I start with just the case A equals 0, and I write out here the equations which are satisfied by the constraint quantities, H being the Hamiltonian constraint quantity and JA being the momentum constraint quantity. Now, a tendency which is sometimes to be observed in physicists is to say, well, here I can express the time derivatives in terms of the quantities themselves, therefore the constraints propagate. However, in order to really prove that the constraints propagate, you need to know more than that. What you need to know is that this system here has uniqueness, because what you want to say is if H and J are zero on the initial hypersurface, they're zero everywhere. So you need to have a uniqueness statement for these equations, and that means you need to have something like hyperbolicity for this system, which is a linear homogeneous system, in order to conclude uniqueness. Now, for this particular system here, as I'll show in a minute, this is symmetrizable. You can make it symmetric hyperbolic just by a simple rescaling. Therefore, you have a uniqueness statement. Therefore, you get propagation of the constraints. And that's been known to me for a while and also known to other people. So this is a well-known thing. What I didn't think about before is, and I haven't seen anybody else discussing in the literature, what happens when A is not zero to this statement here about propagation of the constraints. So I've already said that for A equals zero, the system is symmetrizable. This terminology with symmetric and symmetrizable is something I'll be talking about later on, but this just means that in this case that by multiplying the variables by constants, you can get a symmetric hyperbolic system. Now what I've done here is to write out more generally what equation for the constraint quantities follows from my equation 1, which was the 3 plus 1 decomposition with the constant A left in. And what do we see here? Well, it looks sort of similar to what we had before. Here we have a lower order term, just some quantity coming from the geometry times the Hamiltonian constraint. So that's sort of irrelevant for questions of symmetric hyperbolicity or anything like that. The one important thing is that this constant here changes. So now what I would like to do is I would like to take this system and try and symmetrize it. And the way I do that is to just introduce a rescaled version of the Hamiltonian constraint, and B is just a constant here. So if I do that, then I get the system 4 down here. And now I would like to know when is this system symmetric hyperbolic. And the condition that this be symmetric hyperbolic is that this coefficient here, b to the minus 1 half plus 2a, balances this coefficient here, b. So those should be equal. And if you work out what that means, then I wrote it further down here, that b should be square root of a half plus 2a. So if you choose b that way, then you get a symmetric hyperbolic system here, and then you know that the constraints propagate. However, you have to take a square root here, so the thing you take the square root of better be positive, or at least non-negative, otherwise you're in trouble. So in order to do this symmetrization, we need A greater than minus a quarter. In fact, A equals minus a quarter is also okay, because if you look at the original system here, if A is equal to minus a quarter, then this coefficient vanishes. So the second equation here is just an ordinary differential equation. So you can, in a first step, immediately check the propagation of J, which is now decoupled. And once you've got that, you can substitute that information in here, and you have an ordinary differential equation for H. So it's easy also to check using just usual statements on ordinary differential equations that A equals minus a quarter is also okay. However, if you go beyond a equals minus a quarter, then you're in trouble. Because if you then just substitute the second equation in the first, so not these ones, but the ones higher up, the original equations, then you find that you get this second order equation for the Hamiltonian constraint. And if a half plus 2a is negative, then this equation is elliptic. So instead of having a hyperbolic equation, which will propagate your constraints, you have an elliptic equation. And what this means is that the equations, the original equations, are very probably ill-posed for a less than minus a quarter. I haven't actually been able to prove this, but I think at least if you linearize, probably you can actually prove that the original 3 plus 1 decomposition of the Einstein equations with that value of a is actually ill-posed. Therefore, I think it would be an interesting numerical experiment to do a computation for 1 with some numerical scheme that you know works well for some kind of, doesn't need to be a very long time, but some reasonable moderate amount of time for, let's say, a equals 0, and then try to vary a and see if you see something catastrophic happening when a goes past minus a quarter. Because that would be, I think, a sign of what you should maybe expect from ill-posedness if you do a numerical calculation. I think it would be interesting to just do that experiment to see what happens.
What's the value of a?
So what's the standard ACM system? So I don't actually know the answer to this, but I
it's a
3
Einstein center on the right.
Yeah,
so it's a pi ij and
a 3
Einstein center. But then I've got to translate that to the k.
You've got to translate it. I don't know.
Whatever they are, the ones we have.
So I suspect that it's plus a half, actually, because if you look at this equation, I mean, one special case here is where the Hamiltonian constraint propagates with the speed of light. And that would be a equals plus a half, so I suspect that that's...
I want to try to show evolution of the constraint for the using energy. It doesn't make it work, but...
Well, oh, sorry, a quarter. Yeah, you're right. So I meant a quarter, rather than minus a quarter.
If you just look at your original equation to a less than minus a quarter, is there anything that looks bad?
No, and that's why I think this example is interesting, because it's kind of uncovering something which seems to be bad, which you don't just see if you look at the original. At least I don't see if I look at the original system. Well, I was interested to know what can you expect to see if you try and just calculate an ill-posed system with a code which would otherwise be okay. And Thomas Baumgartner was so kind as to do this for me and just take something he had for calculating the wave equation and change the sign. So it was the Laplacian. And what you see there, and it's once you've seen it, it's kind of logical that this is what should happen. And I guess people here know this. But what you see is that you get, very quickly, you get oscillations, which, so what he was doing, he just had a pulse as initial theta, and that shouldn't be sharp, just a smooth pulse, which just propagates with the wave equation. And when you change to the Laplace equation, something like this comes up very fast, and if you calculate a bit longer, then the oscillation becomes faster. So basically, what you would expect to see, I believe, is that you get this oscillation which doesn't get very large, but which gets high frequency, and basically it will just increase until it reaches the frequency corresponding to the grid spacing. Because basically what Ill-Posness is saying is that higher and higher frequencies grow at faster and faster exponential rates. Therefore, the thing you should see after a while is the one that's growing fastest, which is the one with the highest frequency, and the highest frequency you can do is something with the periodicity of your grid. I haven't shown that they don't propagate, but it's... Yeah, but the fact that it's elliptic suggests... I mean, I think, I didn't have time to do this, but I think if you just linearize about flat space, that you can probably show that the system is really ill-posed, which means that what you could show... both, but actually the original system even... will be ill-posed, and if you give non-analytic initial data, there will be no solution. But I haven't worked that out. But I believe, I mean, you could almost see it here, that the sort of, the idea behind it is that if you have an elliptic equation, then the solution is automatically analytic, provided the coefficients are analytic. So what this would mean would be, if I started with smooth initial data, which wasn't analytic, and worked out firstly the solution and then the constraints, then at the end, because I have this elliptic equation here, this H should be, in fact, analytic, which if I started out with data not satisfying constraints, such that H wasn't analytic, would lead to a contradiction. Now, that argument doesn't quite work, because as Vince pointed out to me, in this equation, in the dot, 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 there are still other things from the metric occurring. So, and they might not be analytic. However, if you linearize about flat space, then I think you just get a system of constant coefficients where you can really push this argument through and show that at least on the linearized level, the equation is ill-posed. And should not be that if the full equation is well posed, then the linearized equation should also be well posed. But that's a good idea. I haven't tried it. Yeah, so I mean, I am talking here about prescribing the lattice and not this densitized lattice which you're talking about. So that's clear. And yeah, so I mean, what I'm sort of trying to do here is not at all to go through all the systems and say which are good and which are bad. I'm just trying to find out some problems of principle of things you might want to look at, or things that might come up. Yeah. Yeah. Okay, so let me just... Yeah. So just to finish off this discussion of this constant A, let me mention a curiosity as I find that this value A equals minus a quarter, where something seems to go bad, actually occurs in a system in the paper of Arbona, Bona, Masso, and Stella, which they say is apparently good numerically. However, this is not a direct comparison since they're using a system of Bona-Masso type, not the system that I'm mentioning here. So you can't conclude a lot from that, but I think it's just maybe amusing that exactly that value occurs in the system. And now, in that context, I've put up another question here, namely, if a system can be made ill-posed by perturbing coefficients, can it be implemented numerically? Because imagine it really is the case that the equation is well-posed, even up to minus a quarter, including minus a quarter, but beyond is ill-posed. Can I actually then implement this system at minus a quarter? Because it seems to me that when I put my sort of data into the computer, then I can't set the constants exactly. So just, you know, if I think of, let's say my system has a coefficient 1/3 in it, and I want to express that constant in binary, then there isn't a finite binary expansion, therefore I have to be on the one side or the other side, and if I'm on the wrong side, I can expect difficulty. Okay, so just another comment here related to this. So if I look at this Shibata, Nakamura, Baumgartner, Shapiro system, or however you want to call it, I just use the abbreviation SNBS here. So there was this study by Miguel Alcubierre and Bergman and others about different kinds of modes when you add different multiples of certain constraints, and I just wanted to mention that in their setup there are actually two coefficients which correspond to, or there are in principle two coefficients which correspond to the one that I have here. And now what they actually do is that, so there's one for the trace part of the metric and one for the trace free part, and what they actually do is to take the trace part equal to minus 1/3, which is of course less than minus 1/4. However, for the other part, they choose a fairly positive value. For instance, plus 1/3 is the canonical choice there. So there's more freedom in that system to actually choose these constants than there is in the system I was talking about. The coordinates are not being changed. What I'm changing is the those equations which I take as being the evolution equation. Coordinates on the space of solutions, you mean? It's not coordinates on space-time. So you could interpret it that way, I guess. So now, since I said that hyperbolicity is a problematic concept, if you like, I wanted to say something in general about hyperbolicity. What does it mean? And there are two aspects of it. On the one hand, the desired features. On the other side, the criteria which you can use to check that some system you have has those desired features. And the desired features are existence, uniqueness, and continuous dependence on initial data in the Cauchy problem. And these three things together are then what's usually called having a well-posed Cauchy problem. However, you can't use this as a very effective definition of hyperbolicity, because then it would mean every time you want to apply the definition, you have to prove a theorem, which is generally going to be difficult. So what you want to have is some criteria. And what these criteria say is, roughly speaking, I have my system of equations, I do some algebra, I identify that the equation belongs to a particular class, and then somebody else has done the theory to tell me that that equation is well posed. And there are various different kinds of criteria, and the unfortunate thing is that there is none which is more general than all the rest. So there are different criteria which are not comparable in generality. And I've listed some of them here. I should be very careful here, because the terminology is not always the same in the literature. So what I've taken here is what I think is roughly the usual modern terminology. However, there are differences of terminology. For instance, I'm talking about strict hyperbolicity, but Leray, who started off a lot of these things, actually used that in a different sense. So there are ambiguities here, but I'm just going to describe these different possibilities in a certain sense, which I think is the usual one in the literature now. So here I just mentioned, so there are four types I'm wanting to talk about here: strict hyperbolic, symmetric hyperbolic, strongly hyperbolic, and Leray hyperbolic. And I just, for a start, mentioned something about the orders of the equations, which are covered here. Strict hyperbolic could be any order. Symmetric hyperbolic is always a first order system. Similarly, strongly hyperbolic. And Leray hyperbolic has this special feature that you can have a system of mixed order. Some of the equations can have one order, other equations can have other orders. So in that sense, it's more flexible. So strict hyperbolicity, in the sense that I want to talk about it here, is the condition that all characteristics of the equation should be real and distinct, and this almost never happens. So this is not a very useful criterion. So as an example, if I take the wave equation and write it twice side by side, this is not a strictly hyperbolic system, because the characteristics are double. So I won't say much more about that one. Then the one I want to say a little bit about next is case 4, Leray hyperbolic, because in the end I won't say so much about it, but I just do want to mention that there, that is the case where you have equations which have different orders. So what you effectively do is that you adjust the orders of the variables. The way you count derivatives is adjusted, and once you've done that, so this goes formally by you choose certain sets of indices, and then once you've done that, what you get is strictly hyperbolic systems or equations of the type I've already mentioned, coupled by lower order terms, where lower order is now in the sense of these adjusted orders. So in a sense, this much more general theory is closely related to the strictly hyperbolic case in the sense I introduced it here. And I'll say maybe a bit more about this adjusting of orders later on, but at the moment I want to go on and talk about the other two definitions, symmetric hyperbolic and strongly hyperbolic, which have, I should say before I go on, that this notion of hyperbolicity has been applied with great success by Ivan Chokhovlat to prove well-posedness of many equations that come up in general relativity. So this has played a very big role in the analytic theory in general relativity. This symmetric hyperbolic systems have somehow played a relatively prominent role in the numerical literature, and what I want to continue now talking about is symmetric hyperbolicity and then strong hyperbolicity, which is, in a sense, closely related. So I start with this equation. One, I just look at an equation dtu plus aidiu is equal to something, lower order terms. So when is this equation symmetric hyperbolic? Well, it's symmetric hyperbolic if the matrices AI are symmetric. This is not the most general symmetric hyperbolic system, but if I have a system of this form, and if the AI are symmetric, it's symmetric hyperbolic. Slightly more general is, and here again is a case where the terminology in the literature is not sort of consistent, but in the sense I'll use it, I call this equation symmetrizable if there exists a matrix R such that the product R times AI is symmetric for each I. And what that means is that if I multiply the whole equation by R, then I get something where, so this R should be symmetric and positive definite. So after I've multiplied, R will be symmetric and positive definite, and this coefficient here will be symmetric. And this is now a symmetric hyperbolic system in a more general case than this one up here. So the general definition is that you should have something symmetric and positive definite before the time derivative and something symmetric before the space derivatives. Now this question of whether an equation is symmetrizable is in a sense just an algebraic question. So I want to indicate this here. So what I do is I replace operators by symbols, which means I essentially replace derivatives by Fourier variables, so that if you imagine a linear system of constant coefficients, you just replace the operator on the Fourier side by multiplication by the symbol. Here I just do it formally, replace the derivatives by Fourier variables, xi, and I use a small letter to denote the symbol. Similarly, I could think of this symmetrizer R as having a symbol, but now, since there's no derivatives, I just think of this as a function of x. So this is, if you like, a function R of x and xi, which happens not to depend on xi. And then the desired condition is the symmetry of this product. So this is a product of matrices, and you would want that. So R should be positive definite, as before, and this product of matrices should be symmetric for all x and xi. And now when you see this in this form, then you sort of realize why symmetric hyperbolicity is it's something that depends on inspiration in a way, rather than method to show that something is symmetric hyperbolic. If you're lucky or clever or whatever, you can maybe find an R that does this, but really what you're trying to do here, you're trying to solve an infinite number of problems for each different xi, and you're trying to do it with this one quantity R. So in a way, it's kind of clear from this formulation that there's got to be something very special going on if you're going to be able to symmetrize a system. Yeah, it could depend on U. I'm just, for simplicity, I just suppress the U. But in general, it should depend on all the variables around T, X, U, and xi. Yeah, not derivatives with respect to T. So now, what strong hyperbolicity has to do with is to say, okay, it's not a good idea to just take an R of X. Let me allow an R of X and xi and see what I can do with that. So what I do is I now allow an R of X and xi as a symmetrizer. This R should still be positive definite. And the fact that R does not depend on xi is simply replaced by the fact that it should be homogeneous of degree zero in xi, which sort of corresponds to the fact that the operator, which I will then produce, is an operator of order zero, as the original R was. So given a symbol of this kind, R of X xi, I would like to associate to that an operator, capital R, which will then be a symmetrizer. And it's possible to do that. It's possible to associate an operator in a natural way, although not completely unique, to a symbol like this. It's a bit like quantization in a way. And in order to do this, you have to use the theory of or at least one possibility of doing it is to use the theory of pseudo-differential operators. And the disadvantage is that this theory is non-local. So you end up having something which is not local in X in order to do the symmetrization. And that, of course, means that on that level, you don't see the locality and the domain of dependence of your original system. However, you can, if you use this approach to strongly hyperbolic systems, you can then, at least often, get the domain of dependence afterwards by other arguments. So you can sort of complete what you lose here by another route. Now, one important thing here is that this R must be smooth in all its arguments. So it must be smooth in X and Xi, and also in the unknown U, if the unknown U is explicitly here. The theory of pseudo-differential operators requires some smoothness of the symbol. It's not enough to just have it bounded or something. So now, given this definition of strongly hyperbolic, that there should exist such an R which symmetrizes the symbol, then you can give criteria for strong hyperbolicity. So the first condition is the one that we've seen before, the eigenvalue should be real. The second one is that the symbol should be diagonalizable, which means there should be a complete set of eigenvectors corresponding to these eigenvalues. And then the third condition is that the diagonalization should be smooth. And that will then allow that this R can be chosen smoothly. And now, I emphasize it is not enough to just check 1 and 2. And this is something which has been done sometimes in the numerical literature, that people have checked conditions 1 and 2 and said it's hyperbolic. But actually, that doesn't in itself prove anything about well-posedness, because you need this third element here. And this example of Courant and Lax, which I'll explain a bit later, is to show that, in fact, this example is not precisely in this context, but it will show that this kind of smoothness is not just some kind of game for mathematicians, but it's really something which is necessary to have well-posedness. However, there is one thing which is probably important for applications in relativity, namely that if the characteristics have constant multiplicity, then condition 3 is automatic given 1 and 2. So in that case, if you know that the characteristics have constant multiplicity, you actually don't need to check condition 3 explicitly. And this tends quite often to be the case in relativity simply because of symmetry requirements. So in a way, you have the symbol and you have some symmetry group, like the group of coordinate transformations in the end, which relates different values of Xi and which actually ends up meaning that the characteristics of constant multiplicity. So maybe in that case, you can get around this this problem, or potential problem. So let me now say something about this Courant-Lax. I've written Courant-Lax system, but it's actually just a scalar equation. So this is a single equation of higher order, fourth order, in fact. And it's not new, it's 1955. So this is in 2 plus 1 dimensions. We have coordinates t, x, and y. And now what I want to do is to take this equation and consider one-dimensional reductions. So I just consider solutions which only depend on a linear function of the spatial coordinates and time, which I call U tilde. And now, if conditions 1 and 2 were sufficient in what I was just saying, then it would be enough to check these one-dimensional reductions, because the algebra you have to do for the full system is the same as the algebra you have to do for the reduction. Now, I emphasize that this is not exactly the same situation. I would like to have an example like this for a first order system instead of for a single fourth order equation. I don't actually have that. Nevertheless, this will show the importance of smoothness and the fact that it isn't just enough, as has been suggested at least orally in the numerical relativity community. I don't know if it's actually on paper somewhere, that it's enough to check 1D reductions to see whether a system is hyperbolic or not. So let's do it in this case. So the 1D reductions are what I have further down here. So this is now an equation in one space variable called R, and I have this parameter alpha, which corresponds to which direction I've taken this linear function in. And now the statement is the system 2, the reduced system, is well posed for every alpha, but the system 1 is ill posed. So that it's not enough to check the one-dimensional reductions. And I'm not going to show that the 2 is well posed, that this is an incoherent and lacks do this, but I would like to just show why 1 is ill posed, and that's not so difficult. So what I note that this system is linear with constant coefficients, so you can hope to analyze it using just some Fourier ansatz. So I make an ansatz e to the I rho r plus tau t, and well, this has got a little bit out of order here, so ignore that at the moment, and just look at what, if you put in this ansatz and require that the equation be satisfied, then you get the following algebraic relation between tau and rho. And now what Couran and Lax do is they choose, for alpha not equals 0, they choose rho equals alpha to the minus 3. That's just a particular set of modes which are particularly badly behaved, and they substitute it into here. And the result then is following. So you now get this relation for tau and rho. And now, in fact, the place where something funny happens with this system is for alpha small, for alpha near zero. So we now approximate this relation for alpha small, which is the same thing as saying for rho large, because rho is a negative power of alpha. And then what you find is that you get this relation here, that tau is given by this expression. And what you see here is that this square root here is something which has an imaginary part. Therefore, the imaginary part of this tau is O of rho to the third. So the imaginary part of tau can go arbitrarily large for these modes. Therefore, there exist plane waves with arbitrarily fast exponential growth, and the system is not well posed. And what is going on here, the reason that this equation is bad, is that at alpha equals zero, you have twofold characteristics, which for alpha equals zero become one fourfold characteristic. So it's a change in multiplicity, as I was saying before, that, that causes difficulty. So you have the characteristics away from alpha equals zero, you have two characteristic cones with different velocities. And for alpha equals zero, you have each of these are double. And then for alpha equals zero, they just come together, and you have one fourfold cone. So that is, in a way, what is behind it. And if you now wanted to construct an example of a first-order system with similar properties, and I'm sure such a thing exists, then the difficulty is just finding a system whose characteristics are sufficiently complicated that you can reproduce this behavior. So I tried a little bit with seeing what happens if you just reduce the fourth-order equation to first-order and so on, but I didn't manage to do it so fast. I guess it just needs some more work to produce a first order example. Okay, so the next thing I want to talk about is identifying well-posed systems. So I should say something here again about the emphasis of my talk. So there are a lot of what you might call designer hyperbolic systems on the market, systems which have been designed to be hyperbolic and which then might or might not be applied to numerical relativity. But what I'm interested in here is less those systems which have been studied a lot than systems which have been practically used in numerics first, and then you can ask afterwards, are they well posed or are they not, and does it make a difference? So that's the sort of question I want to address here. So suppose I've got a system, how can I, if not prove it's well posed, at least kind of get an idea. Is it okay? Is it bad for some reasons? So the first possibility of doing this is inspiration. So guess a way of writing the system in a known form. For instance, show it's symmetrizable. That's a typical example of what I mean by inspiration in this sense. You, for some reason, you're able to guess a symmetrizer and it works and you're happy. But what if this doesn't work? Or what if you have less inspiration? Well, you can get a kind of orientation of whether things work by counting derivatives, in a sense which I'm going to explain now. And in fact, in the context of Lorentz hyperbolic systems, there you have a number of indices that you have to choose, and to me at least, it's quite difficult to see how to choose them. And I think one good way of finding what the right ones are is by doing this counting of derivatives, and then you kind of see how you should adjust the order to make everything work out. So I'll sort of discuss how this works, this counting derivatives. So the first thing is, I split each equation, or maybe subsystems of equations, into a left-hand side and a right-hand side. So the left-hand side would be typically something like maybe a Laplacian or the wave equation or something I recognize, and then on the right-hand side would be lower order terms and all kinds of junk I don't recognize. Of course, that's not unique, but I choose some way of doing that. Then I assign a degree of differentiability to each quantity. And what I want to be able to see, or what I want to try to see, is whether I can do that in a consistent way, so that all the degrees of differentiability fit together and are consistent. And in doing that, there are certain rules which allow me to compare degrees. The one is the kind of obvious thing, that if I differentiate a quantity, then that reduces the degree in this sense by one. So degree means degree of differentiability. And the other thing is that I compare the degree of the left-hand side and the right-hand side and check certain criteria. And the idea of that is, roughly speaking, if I had the equation on the left-hand side with a fixed source on the right-hand side, then I could expect a certain differentiability for the solution of the equation on the left-hand side. So that's what I'm checking in this fourth step. And what has to be checked is the following. Well, at least some examples of what to do. If I have an elliptic system of order m, then the degree of the right-hand side should be no smaller than the degree of the left-hand side minus m. This is the statement that if I solve an elliptic system of order m, I gain n degrees of differentiability. So if I solve the Laplacian, for instance, I gain two derivatives. For a hyperbolic system, hyperbolic systems are a bit worse than elliptic systems as far as regularity is concerned. So here, I would just say the degree of the right-hand side should be greater than or equal to the degree of the left-hand side minus m plus 1. So a hyperbolic system gains one less derivative than an elliptic system. So here's just an example about how this counting of derivatives work. And this is a sort of caricature of the Euler-Poisson system, which is just a simple elliptic hyperbolic system in this case. So I have three different variables here. There are two evolution equations, which I've already written in a form, where I've written certain things on the left-hand side, certain on the right-hand side. And I have this, which is an elliptic equation in one dimension. That's the way I'm thinking of this last equation. And now this is not correct what I've written here. So what I mean is, I don't want to choose u, v, and w this way. I want to choose the degrees this way. So I choose the degree of u is 1, the degree of v is 2, and the degree of w is 0. And now I want to see that this fits together according to the rules that I've just given you. So let's check that this is the case. So if the degree of v is 2, then the derivative of v is degree 1. This is a hyperbolic equation of order 1, so I don't gain anything. Therefore, the left-hand side should also be degree 1. And the unknown in the left-hand side is of degree 1. So I should say, on the left-hand side, I don't count the individual derivatives. What I'm counting on the left-hand side is the unknown. So on the left-hand side, the unknown is degree 1, and the right-hand side is degree 1, so they fit together. Similarly here, ux is of degree 0, w is of degree 0, so the unknown on the left-hand side should be of degree 0, which indeed it is. And in the third equation, w is of degree 0, so the unknown on the left-hand side should be of degree 2, which indeed it is. So all these things fit together, and this is a well-posed elliptic hyperbolic system. In fact, I mean, counting the derivatives doesn't tell me that, but it is in fact the case, and not too hard to prove that that is so. And so I've just written a general principle here. Loss of derivatives is the analyst's nightmare. So this is what we're all the time trying to prevent. it's loss of derivatives, because usually if you lose derivatives, in the sense that these things don't add up, you don't know what to do. Well, you try to gain them back some way by doing some tricks, but the more you lose, the worse it is, of course. And this is, I mean, so this relates to something that Vince has said in a previous discussion, that this elliptic hyperbolic system, which he had together with Lars Anderson, was one where apparently a derivative was being lost. So apparently things were going wrong, but they found a way to see a cancellation which indicated that in fact no derivative is being lost. So that's what he was talking about, in a way, this kind of phenomenon here, which they were able to overcome. Now, what I would like to do is to just apply this derivative counting, just to see what happens to this Shibata Nakamura Bangata Shapiro type system. And I'll take this system in the form that's written in the paper of Baumgartner and Shapiro. And I don't want to write out all the terms. I just want to write out enough terms to show that this goes completely wrong, that this counting of derivatives just doesn't work at all if you do it naively. So I've just written out some of the equations here, and I'm again looking at the special case of vacuum and Gauss coordinates. So here I will remind you what these quantities are. Phi is the conformal factor, capital K is the trace of the second fundamental form, and the gamma tilde is the spatial metric rescaled to have determinant 1. And now one thing I've done here is that I've written the equation for gamma as a wave equation. I mean, originally the equations you have there is dt is equal to some other variable, and dt of that variable is equal to the right-hand side. But actually writing it as a wave equation optimizes the number of derivatives you can hope to get. So writing it as a wave equation gives you an a priori better result than just trying to write it as a system of first order. So I've already implemented that improvement here, but nevertheless we're far away from the thing working out. Why are we far away from the thing working out? Well, the problem is this term here on the right-hand side, the second derivative of phi. What can we expect of phi? Well, suppose I choose some degree of differentiability for this gamma tilde. In general, the way it works with wave equations is that the time derivative of gamma tilde will then be one derivative worse than gamma tilde itself. Therefore, this expression here containing time derivatives of gamma tilde is one degree worse than gamma. This comes into the equation for k. This is just an ODE, so I can't gain anything. Therefore, k is one degree worse than gamma tilde. Here again, k comes into this equation. I can't gain anything, so phi is one degree worse than gamma tilde. But now if I plug this back into here, I've got two derivatives. So this is 3 degrees worse than gamma tilde. But it would only have been allowed to be 1 degree worse if it was going to fit together using the regularity coming from the wave equation. So what this says is that if you just do this counting, you're hopelessly off, not just by one derivative, but actually by two. And, well, the thing is that... that's true. I'm just taking this particular system, right, and saying what does this particular system do? And independent of the question of why this system is in some sense better than other systems, it's sort of clear from the calculations that have been done that this system is good, so it better be well posed, really.
And it doesn't seem obvious you can do this kind of analysis here with these equations without bringing this back into contact with your constraints.
Well, I would say the important question is, are the constraints being used in the numerical calculation, Derek?
Oh, yeah, they're using them.
Why?
Well,
in what way?
If at the initial time.
At the initial time, yeah, but not later.
No, but
so you take initial data that satisfy the constraints, and then you evolve them using this system. So that's, I mean, I'm just taking what is actually being done. I mean, I know there is one trick which involves setting certain things back to zero. So there is one modification, but the constraints are not being used in the evolution, the numerical evolution, as far as I can see. So that's, I think, not a way out.
Yeah, I can't prove anything. The thing that the Einstein equation can't be like some other hyperbolic system where you really have, you know, they're not as local in some sense.
No idea. Yeah, but the fact is that in solving this system, the Baumgartner and Shapiro are not resolving constraints when they solve this system. They're solving the evolutionary system from whatever data they have, which should satisfy the constraints, but then only approximately, because you can never make them exactly satisfy the constraints.
And I think that just emphasizes that this the hope is not, as long as it is not enforced during the evolution with one constraint. And they have to develop numerical techniques which allow to enforce the constraints during evolution, and this was the point where the time evolution became stable. And if you don't do that, what people are doing here is they rely on the fact that the constraint propagates. And in the example of the incompatible Euler equation, you could see that relying on the fact that the constraint propagates doesn't give you a good idea.
So we got to take a look at the fact that the difference in
the numerical change is that the plus example is managed with the dumb equation. So what they do is, what Price was about this Euler equation, they modify the evolution equation by adding a derivative of the constraint to it. And if you boil that back and translate it back to more general mathematical quantum system, you essentially get what the number system does. So, and you...
No, but I mean, again, we can sort of share this argument earlier than Russian mathematics. Personally, I've seen examples where people claim that you can't get basically the same thing that people put as used to saying that it's relativity, it's the evolution of the system, doesn't matter, system. Hopefully, you've got to do what they call divergence and impose the constraint. But there's no doubt that different systematization, they didn't use the equation, they need the more accurate solution. But the question is fundamentally whether or not these things are necessary. So, did these bad solutions not converge, or did they just not give them the kind of results they wanted to find out? This is just thing you need to know this, or remember this. This is numerical analysis. It's most people working in the leading edge. Right? They're always pushing the limit of what the machine can do, working at the biggest possible computation. And then once they're able to go on to a bigger computation, they do, and never come back with their computer power and see what happens with those problems, and just be hopelessly intractable.
So what happened in the case of the incompatible Euler equation is that you run very soon away from the
that solution very badly away in such a way that after a very short integration time,
It really boils down to more of a case of engineering, namely, when you're working with very finite resolution, how can we get the most out of a given calculation? And I think that is a long way away from what we're discussing here, which really are arguments about continuum limits. So I think we should be very careful about thinking over those sorts of observations to define the context that we're discussing here. When we're not talking about finite resolution effects in general, we're talking about switches of principles. So I'd like to go back to, it'd be interesting to take a look at those inconceptual fluid cases and see whether or not what really happened if we could go to the limit, whether it was a case that it was more a case of finite resolution is the problem.
So the point is, if you had infinite computer power, so all systems would be good.
No, that's not true. Absolutely not.
So that works.
That's not true. I mean, maybe the systems we've been talking about, that would be the case, but we've had many discussions and many claims by people in the numerical algebraic community which have nothing to do with evolution. Talking about whether or not particular forms of the evolution equation is all posed. That has nothing to do with the expectation. And that's exactly what we're talking about here.
Yeah, so maybe I should carry on.
Well, before you do, it sounded like that system was not very good from your point of view, but that's the one that works well.
Yeah, that's so this, I mean, my main point in putting this up is to just confess what seems to me like a tremendous embarrassment for the people doing analytical work, that we have this system, which is probably very good, but we just can't see it. I mean, there must be some kind of cancellation going on, I think, but we just haven't seen how to define it.
Aren't with the equations of motion, but they're with the discretization or the imposition of boundary conditions, or a million other things that we're not talking about here.
Yeah, but I think this is. So this, I mean, this embarrassment is independent of the comparison between this system and ADM or whatever. This is, I mean, this one should be good. For whatever reason, the other ones are bad. This one, I mean, everything somehow must come together for this one to a certain extent. Otherwise, it wouldn't be possible to do good calculations. Just maybe one last comment on this system, which is, namely, if you linearize the system, then the problems go away. If you linearize about flat space, then there's no problem here because if you linearize about flat space, then this term here, which is quadratic, goes away, and then the phi and k equations are decoupled from the other equations, and then there's no problems, not only with the terms I wrote here, but at all. And the reason there's no problems is that then you can, you need to know what's here, which is just a k squared, but then you can, at your leisure, assign a higher degree of differentiability than phi and k than you assign to the other variables, and then everything works fine. That you can't do here because of this coupling term. I should be careful. I'm not claiming that I've proved that the linear system is well posed. What I'm saying is that the counting of derivatives works perfectly if you get rid of the nonlinear term. So that's the root of the evil, in a sense, from this point of view.
When I asked that bomb guard about the he told me they were resolving the But that certainly doesn't mean that I don't think I can do that. So I do think we're using that modified. That's correct.
I think the cost, I remember saying something, something looking at the angle of it, Irving Siegel had a formulation in which he put the vector potential, the electric field, and the magnetic field all on the same function. So he said, well, how the hell can you do that? But the magnetic field is a derivative of the vector potential and so forth. But somehow, for whatever reason, it worked if the constraint forced the vector potential to be smoother than what you thought they were, and by the magic of the equation, that's kind of propagated along. But I'm not sure quite where this would be, but I mean, somehow, even if you don't reinforce the constraints at every time, but run them freely, they might be working their magic somehow by being observed by your illusion.
Yeah, the problem.
That's what happened. What's happening? You can't form shots. No?
That's what happened in the other way. They don't follow the constraints that they're talking about, but they also smooth out the solution.
But the problem here is that the problem I see is that we simply haven't seen the magic yet in this case, which, I mean, it would be. Very desirable to do. I mean, one strategy, and maybe I'll try this out, I'd be happy if somebody else tried it out, would be to just say, okay, I sort of simplified the equation by throwing away most of the terms, which were irrelevant for this question. So just take this kind of caricature system, which is much simpler and has the same problem, and see if you can get rid of that problem. And then if you can get rid of it, maybe you can go back to the original system and try and do the same thing then. However, I mean, It might not, yeah.
You might lose that magic.
That's right. And another way of looking at it, constraints is essentially like in relativity, where they could covariant with respect to these four dimensions for the space-time distribution. And if you just throw out the constraints, you're losing that covariant. I think you're losing that
covariant. Anyway, I think it's sort of getting quite late now. I'll just say one more thing before I stop. And this concerns the Bono-Masso system. And when I say the Bono-Masso system, I mean, Bono and Masso have produced many systems over the years. So I mean the original, well, not even the original one. I mean the one from this paper, right, which has been discussed quite a lot. And there was a considerable amount of arguing back and forth between numerical people and analytical people about this. Is this hyperbolic? If so, in what sense? In this paper, they say it's hyperbolic, but they don't say what they mean by that, and so on. So what I want to say is there is a simple answer to this question, namely, this system is symmetrizable. And moreover, almost as it's written in the paper, you can see it. But it's just that nobody actually invested the time and effort to, firstly, work that out, and secondly, to say it, because apparently Juan Masso says he knew that the system was symmetric hyperbolic, but he never wrote it down anyway, which is also not particularly helpful for communication. In Oscar Riula's Living Reviews, he said it's symmetric hyperbolic, but just without further comment. So I think in this sort of situation, it's certainly worthwhile to, you know, when you use the word hyperbolic, to think about what you mean by it, and also say what you mean by it, and say what you know. I mean, just... So that was, I think you were talking about a different later system by the same author. So I'm talking about this particular one, the sort of first one, which was harmonic time and shift zero. In addition to that, I would just mention that there's a later system by Bono, Masso, Seidel, and Stella allowing more general gauge conditions, and there it's not so clear what's going on. In Oscar's Living Review, he makes the following interesting statement. He says, this system is strongly hyperbolic, modulo smoothness. So when he says that it's modulo smoothness, he obviously knows about this point of difficulty I'm talking about, but he doesn't say anything either positive or negative whether the smoothness condition is satisfied. So that's sort of still an open question, whether this other more general system is really strongly hyperbolic. So I won't say anything more here, but except to just say that, I mean, I did work out that this original system is symmetrizable. What is involved in doing that? Simply what you have to do is, well, firstly, so this would be my recommendation or my plea to everybody, in particular people writing numerical papers, please, if you're using a system, say what the system is, completely exactly. Say, I consider the system consisting of equations 1, 3, 15, and 17, and so on. So say what the system is, so then it's easy for somebody from the analytical side to come and say, well, what is the system well posed or isn't it? And this is not so clear in this paper, for instance. So firstly, you have to figure out what's the right set of equations you should be considering. Secondly, so this is not now complaining about what anybody else is doing, but what you have to do, this is the work you have to do, is you have to make sure that you, in a suitable way, substitute in various equations in the original equations such that this criterion with the orders is satisfied. Because often you can write things with plus dot 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 and there are supposed to be lower order terms there, and what you need to check is that they really are lower order terms. Once you've checked that they really are lower order terms, then actually getting the system being symmetrizable is not difficult. It's no more difficult than doing the wave equation on a general metric background. And I think I'll stop there. Yeah, and we would absolutely have settled the discussion immediately, because then everybody would have known what the situation was. It wasn't, in this case, it wasn't something that was difficult to decide. It was just necessary to do it and to say it had been done. One thing I should mention in this context is the fact that, I mean, the nice thing about symmetric hyperbolic when it works is it doesn't care about the smoothness business. Characteristics can be as horrible as they like. If you've got symmetric hyperbolic, you're done. So if you have the inspiration or the luck or whatever to get that, then there's no problem with this point three. That only comes back in if you're trying to check that something is strongly hyperbolic, which is what seems to be necessary for this more general system used later on, which allows more general gauge conditions. Yeah, so I think it's this should be, I mean, this distinction should be made. I would never suggest that people doing numerics should always use a manifestly symmetric form. It's symmetrizable is perfectly enough, but I'm just talking about an explanation of why certain systems, as far as the analytical side can see it, why certain systems are good and certain are not, and then you want to know, does this system fall into a certain class or does it not? Incidentally, why am I even talking about the Bonamassa system? It's not purely as a question of historical interest or something. The reason is that maybe this particular system is not being used today, but actually the kind of manipulation that goes in, which uses momentum constraint in a certain way, does go into a lot of systems. In fact, it was even used before. There was this work of Ivan Chokigawa and with Ruggeri, which Bonin and Masso also cite, where they used the same kind of way of, well, not the same kind of way, but a similar way of changing the equations as such as to get a hyperbolic system. So this is, I think, this kind of manipulation which is being done in the Bonamassa system is something that's likely to keep on coming up in different systems in the future, and therefore it deserves to be understood properly. Yeah. Yeah, and also, one nice thing about having the symmetrizer is that you can be quite sure that the person using, the person writing is really using the canonical definition of symmetric hyperbolic and not his own definition, which has sometimes happened. Go and try. Yes, that's true. And this was in particular why in discussing this one system here, I was using the wave equation form rather than the fully first order form to at least try and avoid that loss. Yeah, so there can be advantages of, I mean, first order systems are nice in a way because they make things rather mechanical. They reduce things to algebra and so on, but nevertheless you could be in a way throwing away interesting useful information or interesting constellations, maybe in a sense, by doing that. Quite true.
Go back to your original question about whether you need a formulation, a 3+1 formulation of hyperbolic.
Yeah.
Certainly Einstein described it in a 4-dimensional formulation in harmonic literature, which is hyperbolic or even symmetric hyperbolic. So we know the Einstein equation is hyperbolic.
Yeah. Yeah, you have to say, who are they? You say, they are well posed. This is a very dangerous thing.
Nobody here is talking about that. We're only talking about, people are only talking about these places and mothers, and then
not manipulating the strength of any kind of hydraulic thing. So it is a little different.
And it certainly is, and there's only probably why one form that's purely strictly hydraulic, and most of hydraulic, that would be three plus one form. Even today, one can't answer the hydraulic and the stair. Very puzzling.
Yeah, but to go between these different forms, you have to use the constraints. And if you say, today I'm going to forget the constraints, then maybe you're working in harmonic coordinates, and then everything's okay, you don't need to worry. To get a well-posed evolution system, but maybe you're doing something else and you do have to work. So these things are only equivalent if you're prepared to fully make use of the constraints. And if you don't use them or only partially use them, then you can't simply say everything that's true for the one system of evolution equations will be true for the other system.
Can I ask just one question for you about the school of Thailand, who global citizen in the hydraulic system? Has anyone proven it using any other belief system? In maximum sizes, right?
Yes.
In the hydraulic system like that, and so that's a gauge choice. Now, the question is, has anyone ever tried to prove a similar result to Christian and Thailand using any other kind of gauge shot, particularly a try and think? Mm-hmm. And is that telling us something really deep? Or is that sort of starting from a culture? Yeah, starting from a culture.
I mean, there is one new, there is now a new version of Christodoulou Kleinema on the market, which does something slightly different, which is due to, Christodoulou was involved, but it's now Kleinema and Niccolo who have been writing this up. And what they do is they want to improve, in a sense, on Christodoulou Kleinema, in the sense that for the Christodoulou Kleinema theorem, you need to have small initial data on a whole R3 Cauchy circuit. But now we know that actually this shouldn't really matter, because if I just take the outside of some very big light cone, then really if I take small data on this region, that should be enough. On the other hand, since the data are falling off at infinity, if I take this cutoff far enough out, it will automatically be small. So now the new version of the theorem says that if I start with any initial data, there could also be matter in the middle, but the matter should be in a compact region, and if I go out far enough, then I get a stability statement close to I-naught, if you like. And that is being proved not using... You don't use maximal slices in that case, because that would be... Well, actually, Christodoulou says you could do that as well, but it's certainly problematic because the slice will then run into here and you need some boundary conditions. So that's, at the very least, problematic, let's say. But what they are doing is doing sort of double null... using double null foliations for this region, which is sort of naturally adapted to this region on the outside of a light cone. So that's the only other thing which has been done, as far as I'm aware.
It should
converge to the solution corresponding to the differentiability you took for your data.
But that's just on the grid, which, I mean, I think in the limit that makes sense, but I wanted to hear, in other words, just putting data on a grid doesn't have any level of differentiability that I can see, but in the limit, presumably does.
Yeah, so that's where the differentiability is going to come in the sense that you're going to say, okay, I have the data which I want to work with, and now I say something about how that data behaves when I refine the grid. That's where the information must be contained.
So you have to keep certain sublet norms approximated on the grid under control, even in a limited size, but maybe
Yeah, so of course there exist these discrete sublayered norms as well. So I guess with a suitable scaling, what you would want to say is that the discrete sublayered norm of the data is remaining bounded for some particular sublayered data. And you know there are these methods of proving existence for symmetric hyperbolic, for linear symmetric hyperbolic systems, which use discretization. They use, in fact, the discretization, which is numerically useless, but which nevertheless, which, I mean, it's unstable, but nevertheless, you can use it to prove existence. You get the convergence that you need for that. So what, in principle, it can mean is sort of well known. No, the linearized ADM system is not nice. If you take so, what would the linearized system be? So let me call H just the linearized metric. Right? So this is equal to, let me just call it linearized Ricci acting on H. So this is what it would be in Gauss coordinate. And now. So what you can do is you can look at this operator, look at its symbol. What properties does this symbol have? Well, Helmut calculated that all the characteristics are real, so that's condition one I had. He also calculated that, sorry?
Light cone
on the deep, yeah, the deep IDT. He also, you see immediately from his calculation that the symbol is diagonalizable, so that's also good. That was the condition two. Moreover, using the group invariance of the situation, you can show that condition three is satisfied. So now you might start getting optimistic, but what you must realize is this is a system of second order. And what I was talking about there was a first order system for a strongly hyperbolic system. Therefore, if you wanted to use that strongly hyperbolic type theorem, you would have to reduce this thing to first order. And what you then find is that if I have a zero eigenvalue in this system, then it gives me a non-diagonal Jordan block in the first order system. I mean, there's nothing mysterious about this. It's just the fact that if I have a zero eigenvalue here, will give me a mode which grows linearly in time. So this is the kind of thing which also plays a role in this analysis by Alcubierre, Bergman, and so on. Right? So zero eigenvalues in a second order system are bad news. So for that reason, I also can't, what can I say about this system? I mean, certainly, it's this growing mode is there. So it's got that kind of bad property. Whether it's got any kind of good property, I can't tell you. No, there is one mode which is constraint satisfying, which is growing. Which is, if I remember correctly, maybe you can remind me of this, but what I believe is that there is a mode which corresponds to, so I am talking about Gauss coordinates here. There is a mode which corresponds to the focusing of Gauss coordinates. Now, it's not directly the focusing of Gauss coordinates which you're seeing numerically, because the breakdown happens at a time which is long before the time when the focusing actually occurs. Nevertheless, it's sort of mathematically related to that focusing of geodesics and Gaussian coordinates.
So,
well, I guess at the end of the day, what is going to be important is, this kind of thing here will be in some sense weakly hyperbolic, but the thing that's going to be important at the end of the day is, if I take the full Einstein equations, how do the nonlinear terms couple to this stuff? Do the nonlinear terms tend to feed this growing mode or not? Because if they tend to feed it, then it could lead to the whole thing breaking down. But if you've got a nice situation where you can make a clean split between this growing mode and the other modes, then things look better. And of course, if you're in the Maxwell equations, the equations are linear, then
yeah, no,
this...
Sorry.
Yeah, so I think, I mean, as Matt was suggesting, it certainly would be a good idea to apply some of these considerations here just to the Maxwell equations and see what comes out, if that might already yield valuable insights in a more manageable context.
Well, I find this hard to believe in the context of the fact that I'm because the assignment works. And I know I can linearize to do with my money, and it will work. So what you're saying is that it is different linearization. That's right. And so what you're saying then is that whatever diseases you see here is in fact extremely coordinate dependent. And that if I use maximum splicing, the linearized maximum splicing, then maybe all these diseases go away.
Well, it could be, but then it's a kind of different problem because you've switched horses from a hyperbolic to hyperbolic elliptic system, which is in itself not bad, but it's a different analysis you have to do.
Yeah. But this comes back down to a question that I asked 5 minutes ago. Is really something important that maybe you shouldn't be doing this in hyperbolic? How about the thing that maybe you should be doing about the goals and staying with natural glasses?
So I mean, of course, this is something that can be discussed by everybody here. But as far as I'm concerned, from everything I've seen, I have no particular bias for either hyperbolic or hyperbolic elliptic. There's advantages and disadvantages, and I see no reason for coming along and saying no, we're not going to use one type. No, we're not going to use the other type.
There is no like before. I think the person that came to say
So I think it is really worthwhile. This was why I was asking this question in your talk, but you know, when something like that is done, it's also important to be careful to kind of take account of this and sort of make it clear, you know, we're not just going ahead and solving the original system, we're actually modifying it in a certain way, which may have an analytical interpretation as well. So I think that... Whereby in the meantime there are more and more different kinds of constraints which come around, so you need to say which constraints you're resolving and which you are. Yeah, that's at least a help. Okay, before anybody thinks of any other questions, I think we'd better stop.